Look at all this, Brett. This is still how the vast majority of the world's goods are transported. On ships.
Unbelievable. And thanks for inviting me down here, by the way. It's my first time in a shipyard.
Oh, dude, don't mention it. Thank you for coming with me. I'm trying to do all possible research on shipping in advance of my interview with Maersk's very own Daniel Wilson, the Director of Business Development at TradeLens. Brett, I'm sure you know all about Maersk, the world's largest container shipping company, but did you know that they're working with IBM to build TradeLens, a truly global trade platform?
Are we in a commercial or something?
No, I just got carried away. Actually, dude, while we're here, can I just say I'm still embarrassed for interrupting your proposal to Ashley a few weeks back? And then all I could do was talk to her about tracing the supply chain of her ring. I'm so sorry about that.
Hey, it happens. You're an excitable guy. You can't be bothered to pay attention to what's around you when you've got blockchain on the brain. It was like that when you used to work together, too.
Yep. I'm a passionate person.
That you are, my friend. Matt, are you getting into a boat?
I am. Nice and tight in this container. And it doesn't close all the way, but here I am. Literally getting carried away.
Wait, is this... Can I get off the ship?
Don't think so. But hey, there's room in the next container over. This is fun. We're a part of the supply chain.
I can't believe this. I knew this was a bad idea.
We're at the forefront of innovation, Brett. Anchors away!
Computer capable of translating volumes of changing data,
bringing whole new meaning to the word trust.
Fantastic powers of electronics harnessed to the service of man.
If there was some way to share the truth.
IBM Blockchain Pulse, the podcast with blockchain evangelist Matt Hooper.
Aladdin's lamp couldn't do more.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of IBM Blockchain Pulse. I'm your host, Matt Hooper, I'm hoping at least one more episode, because I really want folks to stay with me today during the conversation that I am having all around, frankly, the most innovative and exciting trends in supply chain that I've yet come across. And I'm speaking with an expert in the space who looks like he's about to cough. Okay, oh my gosh, folks, we have to cancel. The room is now disease-filled. In all seriousness, I am thrilled to be joined today by, as I say, an innovation expert with regard to supply chain. So please, sir, introduce yourself to me, to our listeners. What do you get to do all day long? And then we're going to talk a little bit about how that is changing as a consequence of blockchain technology.
Yeah, sure. Well, hi, everyone. I can't say I'm a long-time listener of this podcast because it's new, obviously, but I am a big podcast fan, so this is pretty exciting for me. So I've been from Maersk for about 4.5 years now. I come from New Zealand originally.
That's how I have the accent. And just in case I'm not sure, full name and title at Maersk is always a helpful way to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that is, yeah, I'm very bad normally handing over business cards. You can read that later. Doesn't work in an audio forum. My name's Daniel Wilson. My title is Director of Strategy and Operations at Maersk for the TradeLens project.
Exciting. Daniel, I just want to really get this off my chest. Just before we started recording, you were talking about all of your favorite Game of Thrones theories, and you believe the Night King should win. So whenever this podcast is released, whatever the outcome is, I'm putting that on Front Street. This is what Daniel believes. He wants the Night King to win the Game of Thrones for total control of Westeros. Okay, back to our standard programming. Daniel, yes, thank you really for being here.
It's no worries. I'll see if there's a way I can betray you later on.
Exactly. He's also auditioning for the role of Littlefinger. This is a question that I've always wanted to pose to someone from the Maersk, for specifically on the TradeLens team, because I'm aware of TradeLens via the work that we get to do with IBM, but most folks aren't. So what is the future of shipping? Put as simply as possible, what does innovation in shipping look like today? And what will innovation in shipping look like, say, 10 years from now, 2030? And I also asked this out of real curiosity, seeing you here in person, you're a young man who is at the start of his career, essentially, and yet you chose to work with this incredibly old, big company. You're working between two very old, big companies. So I'm really, really interested in learning what you think innovation looks like in this big company.
Yeah. And it's probably to understand where we are now, it's probably easiest to take a look at the recent past of innovation within our industry. And it is not an industry where people have been champing at the bit to get innovation. Essentially, the last 50 years has seen at best incremental improvements or changes to the way that any part of the business model works. So as soon as there was a critical mass of the container, that 40-foot or 20-foot long box that gets put on the ships that can range from, you know, 1,000 all the way down to, you know, 150 feet long,
right,
nothing has really changed.
Are you telling me the container is only 50 years old?
Yeah, 90, well, it's a bit longer, a bit older than that. So mid-1970s is when it became kind of the dominant mode.
Gotcha.
of moving stuff. But 1956, I think it was, a guy called Malcolm McLean, who was an American guy, he invented the container, which was called the multimodal box, because modal, the means of transportation, multi, many. So literally, right, you'd pick it up off the back of the truck, drop it onto the ship.
And it doesn't roll off the tongue as well, let's just be honest.
Multimodal, you know? No. But I think it's still called multimodal boxes, because that's the idea. You can put it on a truck, on a train, on a ship. It is like Lego at that point.
Multimodal boxes beget containers, beget no new innovation for almost 50 years, or roughly 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, you've had such incredible growth in international trade, particularly since like 1980s, 1990s with the World Trade Organization, mm-hmm, that essentially the industry didn't need it. We got pretty good at scaling up the physical side of it for the last, you know, particularly 30 years. And at that point, you know, margins were still all right. Like the actual execution on supply chains was pretty good. And so the innovation just was driving down costs and efficiencies on the operational side.
Sure. And when did the industry decide that you needed this innovation? Like what happened after the 80s and 90s and the explosion of trade?
Well, in reality, it was about 2010 where things started to get a bit trickier, and that was after the global financial crisis.
Yep.
Global trade,
yep,
still growing but slower, and essentially the margins and opportunities for those involved in the supply chain just essentially went down to nothing. So innovation is needed to recognize that we don't have any ways that we can cut fat out of the way that we do business anymore. We've,
sure,
got to find new ways of unlocking and creating value, and that has essentially been the mindset for the last few years about what as an industry can we do to try and drive that.
So what drew you to the industry? I mentioned earlier that, you know, you're at the earlier stages of a hopefully very, very long career.
Or very short, because something goes very right and I can retire.
Right. Or very wrong and the Night King gets you.
Well, yeah.
Going right back to our Game of Thrones references, folks. What drew you to the industry? Where are the greatest inefficiencies at present? So you obviously entered the shipping industry post-2010.
Yeah, so I joined Maersk late 2014 after I finished study in New Zealand. And I had a few different options for graduate programs that, you know, finance and other related fields, consulting, what have you. And to be honest, there was just a lack of tangibility in the sort of work that you could do in those fields.
Right, no multimodal boxes in finance.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's something, you know, visceral about going down to the shore and seeing something with a big brand name on the side of it sail past that's several hundred meters long.
I love that, because that's something that I've never had in any work I've done, and that a lot of folks of our generation I don't think actually think about with regard to this industry. That tangible, visible excitement, being able to stand on the shore and see all the world's goods travel past you.
Yeah, and when you say all, I mean it's upwards of 90% of all stuff goes on a container ship at some,
yep,
point in its life. So it's fundamental, and it's something that needs to be got right. So essentially I was like, well, this is something that can, in the first instance, get me out of New Zealand pretty quickly, because,
right,
it's a great place to live and particularly to grow up, but you know, there are new challenges outside of the country that I wanted to get exposure to.
Sure.
And I also, you know,
and there are no more Lord of the Rings movies to be filmed.
And we got The Hobbit and that, but yeah, we're just gonna have to go through all of the archives and see if Tolkien has any unpublished manuscripts.
Right, and then you can stay in New Zealand and you can work there. So you came into a relationship to I don't want to say an uninnovative or anti-innovative industry, but a slow to innovate industry. Was there an IBM Maersk relationship prior to TradeLens? Like, how was Maersk working with major technology companies before the birth of this new partnership?
Yeah, so Maersk has in the industry always been seen as a technological leader. So Some of the things that we talk about in our industry are fairly forward thinking, even if they are outside of the industry. People would go, well, that's what we already do. So like things like EDI connections, which EDI is functionally the precursor to API technology that was largely driven out of what work Maersk did. Containerization.
Sorry, so you mean like application programming interfaces came out of technology originally built in the shipping industry?
No,
or am I getting,
sorry,
all my acronyms wrong?
No. My syntax was terrible. So EDI technology, which is the precursor to API technology that in our industry was driven by Maersk. Maersk.
Many different kinds of nerds, myself included, were getting all kinds of confused way.
That's my hope.
Like, I think, yeah, that's the whole hope of this whole podcast, let's be honest. Okay.
Yeah, no, nobody did. When I first started at Maersk and they were like, yeah, well, this thing gets done by EDI, I was like, what does EDI mean?
Right.
And they were like, it's electronic something, which is correct.
They're like, you know, EDM, something. It's nothing like that.
You'd be surprised. Yeah. But the,
or it's the drum and bass community of, or I guess waiting for the bass to drop community and shipping. So you weren't seeing technological growth, but you were aware there was a technological, there was a sort of a heritage of technology adoption in the industry long before you started there.
Yeah.
The good times were gone.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, the way that it used to work before containerization is you would have a book, you know, several inches thick, which described the way all the goods were meant to be stored on a vessel.
Okay.
So you'd rock on down to the port. You'd go, okay, so I've got horses, heads and some horses, carcasses. And can you tell me, ship's master, how I can stow this on the ship? And he'd put it in nets and stuff on it. And they'd signed it all off and that'd be what it was. And then we've gone from that to fundamentally not all that much different in the last 70 years. And that's what we recognize on the operational side. That's it. It's just not going to get any better, but we can manage the information.
So I'm going to ask a potentially naive question, because again, our core listenership are fans of the blockchain ecosystem and sort of more software driven technologies. What happened as we saw all kinds of shipping and all kinds of mail services, postal services get privatized? Like, what was going on in the late 70s and early 80s at that same time that we saw a massive increase in what was being shipped? We also saw things being flown around. We saw UPS, we saw Federal Express. Were these not moments industry-wide where shipping executives thought, wow, they're cutting into our business? Like, what was going on there as folks saw an increase in global trade long before anyone was doing things digitally?
From a container shipping perspective, it's not even a rounding error when you consider the volume of goods that are shipped.
Wow.
On air. But in terms of value, yeah, I mean, the reason why you put stuff on air is because you need it there in 24 hours.
Right.
But like, in terms of the volume of stuff, it's very little.
And the example the way you just put it makes it clear it's solving a very different business challenge.
Exactly. Yeah. And on the previous question, which I realized I didn't answer in terms of like technology partnerships.
That's okay. I've moved on emotionally.
No, well, so Maersk has always, like, we've got a partnership with other ones of your other competitors of IBM's that I won't mention for reasons to keep my friends on the other side of the aisle happy. But in terms of IBM, so if you think about the first non-North American director on IBM, it was Maersk Mc-Kinney Moller, who was the founder of the Maersk company. So like, there is a long and established relationship between IBM and Maersk, and this is just one of that paths that we've gone down from that. But yeah, there's a long established relationship. Both companies are about as old as each other at this point, so it's like there was bound to be some overlap in work.
When and how did the Trailands deal come to fruition? What was the origin story there, and how essential was it to your growth at the company, I guess?
So TradeLens, as we know it today, is the culmination of a bunch of different thinking from a whole bunch of different people from both Maersk and IBM and outside the organizations over the last, let's say, call it 3 years. On a high level, the initial work that we were doing between Maersk and IBM was to look at how we can deploy new technologies to improve internal Maersk systems. So just like any company that's been around for a while, we've got legacy systems that are we're grateful when they were built and still are fit for purpose, but they don't allow for that next stage in technological evolution. So it was, how can we go about building that?
You looking at startups? Were you looking at like what was an alternative? It was going to be based on working with IBM sized companies no matter what.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So if you want to bring about that sort of change within an organization as big as Maersk, you need to be working with established players who know what they're doing.
A vendor just as big, for sure.
Cool. Yeah. And so what that means was, we looked at this, we worked it through, and we realized that the challenges that Maersk are facing and the need for information standardization and streamlining is not unique to our company, and the opportunities for something that can affect the entire industry and really drive that change that is necessary is something that we could do in one go. So that was when we took the next step, which is, this is not something that can solve Maersk problems, this is something which can act for the entire industry as essentially a supply chain information system. So that's where the next step was. And part of that discussion was, what are the underlying technologies that can inform that?
Right.
Some of it is like API technology, which in our industry is kind of new and whoa, even though it's been around for like, I don't know, 20 years. And the blockchain technology, which solves a lot of the issues of trust, which is particularly important in an environment like supply chains where parties necessarily don't trust each other and we need to do something about that. So there are a bunch of different technologies that we're going to put into play here, and then we realize, you know, now we need to go out and build that network and build those technologies. So there are a bunch of things that drive that. It's, what are the standards that we need to use? Something simple that I normally, you know, use here is, you know, do you know what the airport code is for Newark Airport?
EWR.
Very good, you nerd.
I'll see myself out of this interview.
Yeah, I think our audience will appreciate it. But the do you know what the port code for the port of Newark is, the ocean port?
Not at all.
And there is none. I mean, Maersk uses one thing. The port of Newark uses something else. MSC, the world's second largest shipping company, uses something else. And that's just a port.
So how are they communicating with each other, or are they not?
Pretty poorly. And
right. They're like waving at each other when you see the ships come by.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, hey, bro. Exactly, hoping that there's enough light to be seen.
Can we come in? It's like, maybe. Yeah. It's a lot of Excel files. It's a lot of EDI connections that break all the time and need to be big teams to keep those going.
Sure.
So it's emails with Excels, it's fax machines, it's stacks of paper, depending on where you're going. So depending on where you are in the world and which port you're going to, the requirements are myriad.
What was your personal introduction to blockchain?
2015, there was an Economist podcast called The Trust Machine. I listened to it and I was like, yeah. Oh, okay, that is totally applicable in our
industry. Not as good as our podcast. Let's just cut to the chase.
Of course. So yeah, that was a revelation, because before then I never understood the idea of digital money and digital currencies, because I was like, all money is digital because I haven't used cash in years, so I don't understand what this is proving. But then I was like, actually, this is something about, representing truth or representing a history of transactions, and we can apply this to a whole bunch of different contexts.
All right, folks, we'll get back to the interview in just a moment. But hey, now that I have your attention, I'd like you to learn more with the limited edition of Blockchain for Dummies, the perfect place to learn the fundamentals of blockchain, how it works, and how it's propelling business forward. Whether you have a good grasp of the technology already or are just getting into it, this is the perfect place to get started. To learn more, go to ibm.biz/podcast-learn-blockchain. Again, it's ibm.biz/podcast-learn-blockchain. There you can download and read Blockchain for Dummies. And look, quite frankly, it would mean a lot to me if you did. And yeah, I guess it would mean a lot to the good folks at IBM Blockchain too. So on that note, you know where to go and you know what to do. Let's get back to the interview. It's a different value system than the way, sort of fiat digital money moves, and also beyond money. I guess this is a perfect transition into understanding what TradeLens does, right? But as you looked at the sort of dysfunction industry-wide and you came to learn about blockchain, how early did you see an application, before TradeLens was birthed? When did you start to understand, hey, this extremely esoteric technology will actually help to have all these disparate parties work together in a trusted way?
So for me, the use case...
And what podcast explained to you how to do that? I guess this is the next question.
No, I don't know about you, but it's that night you finally like go, oh, this is something real, and you spend the next 24 hours on YouTube trying to understand what the hell a nonce is and all these other things. But the right. No, for me, the use case was something called for a bill of lading. So when you watch Fast and the Furious and they go, oh, we'll race you for the car, and they hand over the paper at the end when they lose, and
yeah.
The guy's now got his new Subaru.
And there's always some version of like, we're a family.
Yeah. Come on, Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
I don't know what voice that was.
Was Vin Diesel's encouraging gruff best friend. Encouraging Vin Diesel. Come on. It was sweet. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. wait. Oh, yes. In container shipping, there is something called the bill of lading, and essentially that connotes title. So whomever holds that piece of paper,
sure,
if they rock on up to a port,
yep,
they go, this is actually my container. Which 100 million containers go around the world every year. So
no, it's
40
a very
million
it's a very risky form of proof.
yeah, and incredibly like sclerotic in the way that you can go about managing your supply chain. So
yeah, nice use of the word sclerotic.
Yeah, well, somebody watched West Wing when he was a teenager. But the important thing here is we could solve those issues pretty basically on Excel, right? Most of the time, people, when they go blockchain, actually, it's just they're talking about digital tools.
Right, they're talking about sort of ledger keeping, bookkeeping, ways of organizing different sort of streams of math almost.
Exactly. And so like there is a reason why people, I think, naturally are skeptical of what blockchain is, because in like the most critical way of saying it is just a super inefficient database.
Sure.
But there are particular use cases where it is vital. And one of those is in this instance where you have, in the case of a bill of lading, as many as a dozen different parties interacting with that document and that title at some point, who don't know who the other people are, they don't necessarily trust them, or they have to rely on a whole bunch of intermediaries to stamp and collect and collate and scan all that information.
Yes, well,
all of that could be digitized.
And it's also a form of communication. I just think that's something you're really also getting at, that for anyone who's maybe unfamiliar, it's not just, not saying not just, I mean, it's hugely valuable to be a database, but it's not just a database. It's a way of helping these disparate parties to work together, right? We're also fostering the collaboration between teams that need to be collaborating but aren't. I mean, your example around the port of Newark is I think, vivid. Least of all, because anytime I think about Newark, it's vivid. So how is shipping data accounted for now, and what will blockchain do to record that data?
Yeah, so
like, it's not just Excel spreadsheets, I guess, is what I'm...
There are a lot of Excel spreadsheets. I mean, you have, depending on the... I don't know, capabilities of the system, you're dealing with something like Excel or slightly better than that. Unless you're a Fortune 500 company who's managing supply chains and you have bespoke transport management systems that have been built for you to manage this information, most of the time you're using Excel or Word or other like Office products,
right,
or Lotus Notes. There we go. To try and make the, to try and manage your
that
your,
will serve as the commercial.
Yeah, it's fine. This episode is brought to you. That's what we're dealing with, as an industry, that even if you're, you know, dealing with, you know, millions of dollars of export goods, you are still using Excel to manage your supply chains. And that's kind of average case scenario, all the way up to like fairly modern API driven environments, all the way down to literally just I'm writing down my commercial invoice by hand and I'm going to put that in a DHL envelope and send that over the world.
What does DHL stand for?
I don't know. It's the UPS of Europe.
It's so fascinating that so much of the world is just letters that we don't really know the meaning of. There's something kind of tragic about it. I'm not sure what it is. We'll figure that out later. This episode is brought to you by a sad guy. I'm kidding around when I say stuff like that, but not really, because I think in order to really actually structurally innovate, you need to be able to decode and demystify some of the processes that are sort of unnecessarily... That unnecessarily obfuscate the way that the industries are actually working, right? So TradeLens comes along as an idea birthed in this collaborative environment to clarify, to make more efficient. What was the time between you first reading that Economist article, knowing that you had a long-term relationship with IBM, and creating this new venture?
Well, I mean, the work that I did was contributory rather than central. So
we should be interviewing someone else. Anybody?
No, I mean, there have been now we've got well over 100 people working on this full time, and over the course of the last few years, like the unique number of individuals is probably approaching 1,000 who have had some contribution to the development of this, from the regulatory side to the technology side, and going out and advocating for the platform. So I mean, it really is something that came out of teamwork, I guess. One of the things which is, I guess, apropos with the collaboration arrangement that we have.
Yeah, but it's great. So what is this? You know, I think that's there's going to be folks that want it. They can obviously check out your website, but how would you define and explain TradeLens to those who maybe roll their eyes and they think about how ancient and inefficient shipping is? How do you get us all excited about it?
Yeah, so if we build from the most basic elements up, the TradeLens platform exists in three layers. So on the foundation of TradeLens is the supply chain ecosystem itself. It's those ports, it's the shipping lines, it's banks, it's importers, exporters, it's their brokers, it's their third-party logistics providers and freight forwarders.
Which
it's,
are already so many different relationships to keep track of. I just want to be clear.
Like, yeah, so like an average end-to-end container shipment involves more than 30 organizations, more than 100 people, and more than 200 information exchanges. And
any one of those. Can you say that again, please? Is mind-blowing.
So 30 organizations, so, you know,
customers. For your average container shipping transaction.
Yeah, 100 people who are doing data entry or scanning or on the phone, and every time they need to send a piece of information across, there's more than 200 of those in an end-to-end journey.
So we should be grateful anytime anything is shipped anywhere.
Oh, it's shocking that any of this works.
This is a disaster.
Yeah.
Okay, this is exciting.
Yeah, it's great. It's truly remarkable that at the scale that we're able to do it, things kind of still work pretty well.
Yeah.
But we...
Thank you, Lotus Notes.
Yeah, it's just them, in case anyone was wondering. But, you know, TradeLens is saying, look, we've got that ecosystem. We want to bring us together and have us speak in a common language.
Sure.
So we want to bring everyone together and then with them and with the rest of the ecosystem, use and leverage standards for information transmission. And that sounds like obvious, but something as simple as what do we call this port is not standardized, all the way up to how do you structure a commercial invoice, what do these different pieces of data look like. That's something which needs to be built from the ground up. So we've gone out there and we're very pro open standards. All the information and how you structure it is all available online, and we think that's important because this is not a matter of building a monopoly or building anything which can control information flows. It's about building a set of neutral tools that the entire supply chain ecosystem can leverage.
So what is Maersk and I? Who owns what? That's a complicated idea for companies specifically like yours. From the IBM perspective, I understand it, but you're not historically in the platform business, creating neutral platforms.
So, that's right.
So what is the stake?
Right. So if we come up to the middle,
or I guess what are the stakes? Apologies. I need to get my singular and plurals down.
Yes, listeners will note that he's been saying data is the whole time, but we'll move on beyond that. Now, the second layer of, I mean, you can think of TradeLens like a layer cake, and the cake, not the Daniel Craig film. But
right,
the, so
right.
The bottom,
and also to go back to our singular plural thing, not a layers cake.
Very good. It's not like attorneys general. So you got the foundation layer. In the middle is the technology layer, or the platform layer. So these are where all the APIs sit, all the data sit. Yep. This is where blockchain sits. It's where our permissioning structure sits, which is essentially the thing that determines who can see what at what time.
Yep.
And the thing here, which is like unique, but not in a general sense, but specific to our industry, is that the data are real time. So as soon as it's recognized in a data source, it is recognized in our system.
Why is that unique to your industry?
Because when you have EDI connections, which is the best case scenario, those are batch processing. So every certain amount of time, all of the transactions will then be pushed out to the receiver of those data. But that could be, you know, best case scenario, every half an hour up to every 2 days.
Receiver of those data.
Mm. But that's best case scenario. Worst case is you're dealing with Excel or you're dealing with other more baroque systems that need to be updated and refined and reviewed and sent out and converted and consumed.
If I may take a step back, so I want to go back into the partnership. Who makes these decisions? This is a very big change. Like the way you're describing the industry up until now sounds pretty hard and fast. How do you get that kind of buy-in from the top? I mean, that to me is what's so exciting about taking this kind of leap, is you've had to, because it's such a personal industry is what I'm learning. Mm-hmm. It involves so many people working with fairly antiquated tech, or I don't want to say antiquated technology because it's still useful, but older technology, right? This is not where you want to go if you want to work in the highest of tech fields. So who's endorsing this project in your company, and where are you obtaining support?
Yeah, so in our company, we've got support from Søren Skou, the CEO of Maersk, and the chairman of the board, all the way down to, you know, people in the front line who their full days are dealing with these information inefficiencies.
Do you think that if you didn't have that, right, could a company be able to engage? Can a company engage in this level of new venture creation without that kind of top-down support?
Not like this, but I think you'd get it anyway in this context. So just like a personal anecdote, when I first started at Maersk in the graduate program, did rotations like you normally do. Mm-hmm. My first rotation was in customer service. Pretty basic day is, so you know when you turn up to the airport, you have to check in at a certain time and be at the gate at a certain time. And if you don't, you miss your flight.
Yep.
pretty simple equivalent in container shipping as well. You need to provide all your information and have that at a certain time, and then your container needs to turn up at the port at a certain time. So we'll give what we call the load list, which is kind of like the manifest, to the port, and we'll say at some point you're going to load 1,000 containers on. It's these 1,000 containers.
Okay.
The port will go, okay, it's, you know, an hour before the containers are meant to be here and the following 100 containers aren't here. Are they going to turn up or not?
Yep.
Because we'll need to restow the ship, replan it, change, it gets super inefficient on the port. And we'll go, don't know, because our systems don't have that visibility. So we'll call up, for example, the freight forwarder, who's like the travel agent of the supply chain industry. They have a far more involved role than that, but it's, for those who don't know, that's kind of the analogy. And they'll go, well, we believe that the container is currently under the control of the exporter themselves, so give them a call and find out. So you call them up, and they go, oh, yes. The truck driver actually just pulled out from the depot about an hour ago, so maybe call the trucking company. So you call the trucking company, and they'll go, oh, yeah, we just radioed the truck driver. He's not far away. So you call the port back, and you go, he's definitely going to turn up. And they go, yeah, we know he turned up about 15 minutes ago. And you've just wasted an hour of your day, and that happens all the time.
Right.
And 80% of our customer service time is spent answering those questions.
It's like an industry sort of designed around the same frustration you feel when your cable guy has to come.
Yeah.
Anytime between 2 and 5, between Monday and Friday.
That's right. And 2 at 5 a.m., of course. Yeah. But that's essentially what the industry is. So from the person at the very front of the organization who's spending 80% of their time answering the same question, where is my container, all the way through to the CEO whose balance sheet is taken up with a disproportionate amount of cost because of inefficiencies, not because of anything that is like not easily solved, all the way through that gamut is a huge amount of support for something that's going to drive information standardization and the real-time communication of that information.
So that's incredibly helpful context. And the sort of beginning of
in
finding
post, we'll recut this. So.
Exactly. We'll re-chronologize. No, I think that is the way to almost, he sort of dove in and then took us back, which I like. So TradeLens, when, so 2016 was when that really first got off the ground, is what you're saying, yeah?
Yeah. Roughly? Trying to remember my dates. Yeah, 2016, 2017, yeah.
What was the executive buy-in for this new blockchain project, which I'm sure at the time people were finding synonymous with Bitcoin, consequently synonymous with major, major risk. You know, what was the sort of onboarding process internally like for that? How did you get people excited?
People have more recently, and I say more recently, in the last 4 years, recognized that, thankfully, blockchain goes beyond cryptocurrencies and tokens. You don't need that idea. And in fact, if you boil it down to what that economist headline was, which is the trust machine, that is it. That is the thing that is being solved by blockchain in our industry. And when you deal with those personal relationships and having all these intermediaries who essentially gatekeep information flows, when you can say, look, instead of having to trust people and trust the people that they trust, you can just all look at this singular piece of technology, understand it, and come to trust that, that's going to solve all those problems. Then talking about coins and crypto and all those other things is secondary. It's the principle of distributing ownership of truth that everybody goes, ah, okay, this is actually something that I want to get behind.
Interesting. You talked about sort of industry-wide innovation. What is TradeLens up to in about 5 years from now, let's say? Let's not look all the way to 2030. What year is it? What year is it? 2019. 2024.
Yes.
What is TradeLens product roadmap, I guess?
Yeah, so if we go back to that delicious layer cake, we've got the foundation of the ecosystem.
Clearly that's what threw off that question. I was so stuck on the thought of layer cake. And then trying to remember the plot of the Daniel Craig movie.
Yeah, I've been thinking
movie.
About it too, in the end, the twist. Yeah. I don't want to ruin it for anyone.
It's 15, 14 years because it's 2019. Yeah, and Daniel Craig's last pre-Casino Royale.
That's right. How good was that movie? Anyway, I'm totally dragged. Yeah, middle layer of the layer cake is the technology and where all the data sits. And then essentially that ecosystem and network and those capabilities are exposed via APIs externally. And the idea is the top layer of TradeLens will be an applications marketplace where both TradeLens collaboration and third parties will build capabilities on top of their platform, which lever different parts of the data stack and the technology stack in order to create value for their customers.
Wow.
So 5 years from now, if we do this all right, much of the capabilities that will be on the platform will be built by TradeLens. So we've got a visibility tool, a blockchain-based documentation sharing tool, automation engines that allow for people to create documentations to do customs filing, et cetera, automatically, which today is a very involved process, e-bills of lading, booking and shipping, all of these basic capabilities we'll have on the platform. But at the same time, in 5 years, at least as many capabilities we want to have been enabled by third-party developers who, just like a perfectly open ecosystem, can come along and build and create value.
This is such a big idea, the idea of opening the ecosystem, right? Like, this is something that I've had the privilege of both doing professionally, frankly, before they stuck a pair of headphones on me and put me in the corner. Right now, we're in a cave, everybody, if anyone's wondering where we are.
It's the echo.
Yeah. And also that I've had the privilege of being able to, you know, conduct a lot of interviews around. What is the Maersk ecosystem strategy? To be fair, you're working with, in the case of IBM, for example, partners you've worked with for many, many years. That doesn't sound like an open ecosystem. When you say open ecosystem, what does that mean?
So something as simple as all of the technological information needed to totally replicate TradeLens is available online. So if you wanted to go and build your own one, you could do that immediately. And that is important because if you know what all those technological primitives are, you can totally use and lever the work that we do as TradeLens, building an ecosystem, building out capabilities, to then do the last mile and build an actual product that sits on top. So back to that layer cake, the bottom two layers, the ecosystem and the platform, functionally are like neutral utilities, which we will build and invest in and develop. And then the monetization happens through that top layer, that applications and services layer. And it's in our interest to make sure that we act in a way that doesn't privilege anyone in that ecosystem above anybody else. Because essentially, this will be a profit-driven initiative, and we need to make sure that we build things that the ecosystem is willing to pay for and facilitate the build of things people are willing to pay for. Because if we don't, I mean, we'll be out of a job. So it's important that the incentives align to make sure that this is as open and neutral as it possibly can be, while also scalable. And we think we've got that.
Is part of this plan to turn Maersk into a technology company?
No, absolutely not. So Maersk will remain functionally an asset user. So, you know, we're not going to get rid of any of our ships. Our freight forwarding capabilities will still have, you know, the greatest amount of factory and warehouse storage space in China, for example. You know, we're not moving away from that. This is part of our plan.
Or sort of shrinking, like as many companies are trying to do in the digital era.
Yeah, so we're expanding. We think that the digital tools that are being developed will, regardless of who develop them, commoditize much of the, you know, modular capabilities that companies can bring to the fore. We are going a long way through what we call our One Maersk strategy to integrate a lot of those fundamental capabilities on a physical asset side, factories and trucks and trains and ships. But you need to pair that with an equally as integrated information flow, and that's what TradeLens can enable. But the good thing is, you know, Maersk is focused on container shipping, but supply chains go far beyond the container.
Right.
And that's where we want TradeLens to end up being is, you know, there's something that Maersk, as well as MSC or CMA or Costco, who are these other big shipping companies around the world, we can focus and be very good in one area of that, but TradeLens can manage that end-to-end information flow. So from the moment you want to know, you know, the resins that you need to make the foam packaging for all the, you know, all that is something on an end-to-end basis we can eventually facilitate. And the different providers of assets under that can maximize their modular components under that.
So the terms of the TradeLens partnership are described as visible, secure, and flexible. Practically speaking, can you provide examples of said visibility, security, and flexibility?
Yeah, so let's do visible first. So there are two ways that visibility is we're making that. We're making visibility visible. Right. The first one is, as I say,
Making sure people can see visibility.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Perfect.
So, there are two ways. The first one is, like, everything we're talking about here today is documented in detail online. So it's visible what we're doing and how we're doing it. But then in terms of if you want to use the system to get access to shipment visibility or container visibility, the granularity of information that we have access to is literally an order of magnitude greater than that of existing solutions out there today.
Wow.
So getting that nuance view of what's happening in your supply chain will give you the tools as an importer, as an exporter, or as your agents to act in a way that is going to you know, more likely find the causes of value destruction and fix those. Yep. Because today, when you spend all your time on the phone for an hour trying to find out where the container is and then the issue that you're on the phone for resolves itself, that is an hour that you've now just unlocked for your workforce to go out there and do root cause analysis and stop that from ever happening again. So that's the first one, visible. Next one was secure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are two things here. The first one is that you need to be able to trust that the information you're, you know, relying on is right and comes from the right people, so you can securely make decisions in your supply chain. So can I trust that this thing that I'm receiving now is actually title, and so I can release $50,000 in a payment to the person who's selling this to me? Like, that security and security of mind, if anything, is a fundamental element to how blockchain in particular can unlock or solve those issues of trust.
Right, because you're employing a sort of a trusted technology anyway. You're helping to ensure that every transaction is trusted.
Exactly, yeah. And then that goes onto the second layer, which is, you know, you need security. You need to make sure that when you provide information, you only give to the people that should be getting that information. So if you're right. putting a commercial invoice out there, you don't want your competitors to get their hands on it. So the way that what we call our data sharing specification works is it essentially breaks that down to the most minute layer or level to see, of these data, who is responsible for providing it and who can possibly consume it within the context of that end-to-end shipment. Mm. So security is fundamental, because you need to know that you're not, you know, essentially giving away the secrets of how you do your business. And you can do that while at the same time benefiting of the scale of a network-based environment that you're engaging with.
And flexibility.
Yeah, so flexibility. With open APIs, you can essentially have a much more resilient technology stack that you're building off of. So there are probably like 5 people in the world today who know how to properly code on EDI and use that technology. It's more using hyperbole.
Well, I am one of them. That's the twist.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. But, you know, it's a non-resilient system that you can't really do much with. But with open APIs, you can pick and choose different data fields and elements from all these different capabilities and put them together in ways that haven't been done before in order to sell that. So you might want to build a supply chain optimization tool that is particularly interested in, you know, 5 different data points that can inform the model, or 1,000 different data points that can inform the model. And those are all available through the TradeLens platform. So that's how flexibility can help.
This is a more sort of, I guess, philosophical question, but what is the comfort level, sort of from a business standpoint, with owning so little of a major, major part of your next 10, you know, of your next decade's strategy, output, you know, like all the new hires they'll be making around it? It is a risk. You're taking the risk with trusted partners, but again, you're not. This isn't Maersk owned in a way that the ships you're talking about are, and the factories you're talking about are. What had to happen in the company culture for that risk to be okay?
Maersk has always been very happy to try new things and to drive value creation for our customers. So we were the first that really brought out what are called refrigerated boxes, or I guess hilariously named reefer boxes, and particularly the sort of range that we have. We were the first to put Internet of Things devices on the side of them so that they could be known where they are and what temperatures inside them or what have you. We recognize in Maersk that there is a, you know, an upper limit that can be reached from working on your own and essentially trying to, you know, maximize your internal systems. In the last 7 years, Maersk and MSC were the first in our industry to do what's called a formalized vessel sharing arrangement. So you know how on airlines you can code share and you book on United and it's a Lufthansa plane and everything's A-okay when you turn up at the airport? That's a pretty new concept for container shipping. And Maersk did that with MSC, our number two competitor, because we recognize that, you know, this is unsustainable if we try and go and do it ourselves.
How many years ago, you said?
About 7 or so.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a genuine recognition in an industry that, you know, no man is an island, or certainly no company is, and which would be fine because we've got ships, but, you know, this metaphor doesn't become more labored because of it. You know, we've got to make sure that we work in a way that is collaborative and does allow for that increased you know, collaboration with other parties, including our competitors. Now, the good thing is the things that we are good at do not get at all affected by this in a deleterious way. So the things that we're good at is customer service, is the underlying technological assets that we have our hands on. It's the network and the expertise that we bring to bear in the other assets. And that's what a lot of companies have. They have particular comparative advantages in those spaces. But everything gets drowned out at the moment because essentially we spend all of our time and all of our money dealing with the zero value add of getting information all in one place, trying to standardize and translate that into a consumable format, and doing stuff with the information after you spend all that time getting it in one place. So your ability to maximize on your true capabilities, your true differentiators is next to nothing. So when you remove that part of the equation for everybody, then people can start focusing on the things that they are really good at, which may be warehouse space, for example, that a freight forwarder is particularly good at both creating and utilizing for their customers. It might be inland haulers who are able to now, you know, just something as simple as turn up to the port when the container is ready to be picked up rather than waiting for 4 hours outside and creating huge traffic jams. Like, small amounts of value can be created across the entire supply chain ecosystem because people no longer have to wait for information or actionable instructions.
Yep.
They can take that as a given and start using that in their day-to-day businesses.
That's great. Finally, for those companies Maersk's size, they may still be dubious, skeptical of blockchain adoption, of implementing blockchain for business. What might you say to them as someone sitting in the driver's seat of an incredibly exciting blockchain collaboration?
I think everybody gets that this is something we should be doing. We recognize that as an industry, there is just so much left on the table because information is just trapped in all of these different silos. And because of that, and because of a lack of standards, we're unable to then spur the next, you know, generation of innovation within our industry.
Right. Maersk : innovation excavation. There you go.
Yeah.
It's your new slogan.
Yeah. I mean, we'll workshop it. Let's see how it goes.
We'll get a focus group together.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, some pizza. So everybody kind of gets it. It's not so much what, like, is this something we should be doing? It's, is this particular implementation,
right,
does it, you know, pass muster in terms of actually living those values of openness, neutrality, as well as visible and flexible? And we think that we've got a number
and secure.
Of,
I mean,
and
you're secure,
right. Yeah. And
that I know your values better than Maersk does. Oh my goodness.
Well, Maersk has a booklet that every new starter gets. This is 100-year-old values that we live by, and they're different from the ones we just talked about. But the important thing from the industry perspective is, like, how can we put in place the right governance structures, the right incentives to make sure that this collaboration and whomever contributes to it in the future,
sure,
are doing it in a way that is for the entire supply chain and ecosystem and not just for Maersk or not just for IBM.
That's great. It's ecosystem wide, it's company deep, and it's based on your values.
Exactly.
And that's the nature of the TradeLens partnership. Daniel Wilson, thank you so much for being with us here on the IBM Blockchain Pulse podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you
very much.
Thanks for taking me out to dinner, Brett. This is delicious. What is it, linguine?
It's a hamburger, man.
No, I mean, what's in the burger? The little things, the... Well, the name will come back to me.
Matt, I'm worried about you.
Why? Because I can be forgetful?
Because I thought that, yes, you could actually confuse a hamburger with linguine. Because I'm your friend, and all you ever seem to do is want to talk about blockchain.
It's my job, Brett.
It's your job to jump into containers on cargo ships?
Hey, you've got to admit that was fun.
Dude, I've got it. I know just what to do.
You do?
Yes. We're going to a concert, you and me. You love live music. It'll be good for you. You can get out, take your mind off of work.
Well, it has been a while since I went to a show. Okay, let's do it.
Awesome.
Just tell me when, though. I'd love to make sure it's before my interview with the founders of True Tickets, who are building an event ticketing solution in collaboration with IBM Blockchain.
Oh, boy.
Our going to the concert can be very formative in the shaping of that episode. Brett, this is a great idea, my friend. Concert ticketing, a brilliant next use case for blockchain.
IBM Blockchain Pulse with Matt Hooper. Follow us on Twitter @IBM Blockchain.